A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a proper history of tech episode with a bit of Cape Cod nostalgia baked in. He's asking about Wellfleet, the little town on the Outer Cape, and specifically its claim to fame as the site of Marconi's pioneering transatlantic wireless station. The South Wellfleet Station, 1903. First wireless message from a U president to a European monarch, Roosevelt, to Edward VII. But Daniel wants us to walk through what Wellfleet was before Marconi showed up, what the station actually was technically, the human drama around it, and then the real meat, were Marconi's wireless experiments, the true forerunners of today's subsea fiber optic network, or were the actual undersea telegraph cables. Cyrus Field, the gutta percha era, the 1858 Atlantic cable, the truer ancestors. He wants us to make the case both ways and argue it out.
Oh, this is a fantastic question. And by the way, today's episode is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, so we'll see if it can keep up with a proper transatlantic technology debate.
Well, if it starts hallucinating a fifth Marconi tower, I'm calling it out.
So where do we start? The town itself?
Let's start with the ground before we get to the towers, because Wellfleet before Marconi is a whole world. This is Outer Cape Cod. It's a narrow spit of sand and scrub pine sticking into the Atlantic like a flexed arm. Before Europeans showed up, this was Wampanoag territory for thousands of years. The area was called Ponomoyuk. The Wampanoag had seasonal settlements, fished the rich waters, harvested shellfish. The name Wellfleet itself comes from the Old English Wallfleet, after an oyster bed in Essex, but the original inhabitants had their own deep relationship with that coastline.
The shellfish piece is no small detail. Wellfleet oysters are legendary, they're still famous today, but back in the 1800s, this was a serious oystering economy. The town incorporated in 1763, and by the mid-19th century, Wellfleet was one of the major oystering ports on the eastern seaboard. We're talking about fleets of schooners, thousands of barrels shipped to Boston and New York. It was also a whaling outpost, not on the scale of New Bedford or Nantucket, but Wellfleet had its own whaling fleet. The town's population peaked at over 2,000 in the 1850s, and a big chunk of that was built on oystering and fishing.
Then the oysters collapsed. Overharvesting, disease, siltation. By the late 1800s, the oyster beds were depleted. The population dropped. Wellfleet was becoming a backwater, which is exactly why Marconi's people could acquire land there cheaply. It's this recurring story in tech history. The pioneering installation lands somewhere that's economically depressed because the land is available and nobody's fighting the zoning board.
Marconi came to Wellfleet in 1901, originally setting up a temporary station. But the permanent South Wellfleet station, the one that made history, was built in 1902 and went operational in 1903. And this was a serious engineering installation. We're talking about four massive wooden towers, each 210 feet tall, arranged in a square. They supported an enormous antenna array, essentially a web of copper wires strung between the towers, forming what was basically a giant spark gap transmitter.
210 feet is tall for wooden towers in 1902, on a windswept cliff. That's not trivial engineering.
Not at all. The towers were built of untreated timber, bolted together, braced with guy wires, and they sat on a 50-foot clay cliff overlooking the Atlantic. The location was chosen very deliberately. Marconi wanted unobstructed line of sight to the ocean, and the cliff elevation gave the antenna a better radiation pattern over salt water, which is highly conductive and helps ground wave propagation. The station building itself housed the spark gap transmitter, a massive bank of capacitors and an induction coil that generated high-voltage sparks across a gap, producing damped radio waves. There was also a coherer-based receiver, which was the standard detector technology of the era, metal filings and a glass tube that would cohere when a radio signal passed through, changing resistance and triggering a relay.
The Gohira is one of those devices that sounds like alchemy, but actually worked reliably enough to build a business on. And Marconi was very much building a business. People forget, he wasn't a scientist in the pure sense. He was an entrepreneur who understood radio empirically. He cobbled together existing ideas. Hertz's spark gap, Branly's Gohira, Tesla's resonant circuits, and turned them into a commercial wireless telegraphy system. And the Wellfleet station was his American beachhead.
And the big moment, the one that put Wellfleet on the map, was January 19, 1903. President Theodore Roosevelt sent a message to King Edward VII of England. It was the first transatlantic wireless transmission from a U head of state to a European monarch. The message was transmitted from the South Wellfleet station to Marconi's station at Poldhu in Cornwall, England, about 3,000 miles across the Atlantic. And this was a huge diplomatic and technological milestone.
What did the message actually say?
It was a greeting. Roosevelt expressed the hope that wireless communication would strengthen ties between nations, something to that effect. The text itself was diplomatic boilerplate, but the fact that it worked at all was staggering. Remember, just 2 years earlier, in 1901, Marconi had claimed to receive the letter S in Morse code across the Atlantic at Signal Hill in Newfoundland, and even that was controversial. Some scientists doubted it was possible given the curvature of the Earth. The Wellfleet transmission was more robust, more verifiable, and involved an actual head of state.
The Wellfleet station was operational for about 15 years, right? But it had a rough run.
Rough is an understatement. The towers kept getting knocked down by storms. The first major incident was in 1902, before the station even went fully operational. A storm collapsed the antenna array. Then more storms. The cliff itself was eroding. This is the outer cape. The Atlantic is constantly chewing at the shoreline. By the time World War I rolled around, the U-Navy took over the station as part of wartime security measures. All wireless stations were nationalized. After the war, the Navy decommissioned it. The equipment was stripped, the towers were eventually dismantled, and the cliff kept eroding. Today, the original station building is gone. It fell into the ocean decades ago. What's left are the concrete foundations and some structural remnants preserved as part of the Cape Cod National Seashore. You can visit the site, stand on the cliff, and look at the Atlantic from exactly where Marconi's towers once stood.
There's something poetic about that. The most advanced communications technology of its era, reduced to concrete footings on an eroding cliff. Which brings us to Daniel's bigger question. Who are the real ancestors of today's global internet infrastructure? Is it Marconi's wireless vision, or is it the undersea cable builders?
I'm going to make the case for Marconi, and I'm going to make it forcefully. Look at what we're actually doing today. The majority of internet traffic that crosses oceans, and I'm talking about the traffic that matters to end users, doesn't go through cables alone. It goes through a hybrid system where wireless is the last mile, the access layer, the thing people actually touch. But more importantly, Marconi's real legacy isn't point-to-point wireless telegraphy, it's the conceptual leap. He proved that you could send information through the air across oceans without a physical conductor. That idea is the direct ancestor of satellite communications, of cellular networks, of Wi-Fi, of Bluetooth, of every radio-based technology we use. When you make a video call from New York to London, the signal might traverse a subsea cable for most of the distance, but the first and last hops are wireless. The architecture of modern communications is fundamentally Marconi's architecture, information radiating through the electromagnetic spectrum.
Herman, that's beautifully argued and completely wrong.
I knew you'd say that.
The subsea cable builders are the true ancestors, and it's not even close. Here's why. 99% of intercontinental internet traffic travels through fiber optic cables on the ocean floor. Not satellites, not wireless, physical cables. The modern subsea fiber network is the literal, physical descendant of the 19th century telegraph cable network. The cable-laying ships used today by companies like Subcom and Alcatel Submarine Networks are the direct technological descendants of the Great Eastern, the ship that laid the first successful transatlantic telegraph cable in 1866. The whole operational pattern, surveying the seabed, laying cable from giant drums, splicing segments at sea, deploying repeaters every 50 to 80 kilometers, all of that traces directly back to the telegraph era.
The telegraph cables carried Morse code. They were copper conductors insulated with gutta percha. A modern fiber cable is glass fiber carrying modulated laser light. The physical medium is completely different.
The medium evolved, but the pattern persisted. And here's the key thing. The repeater problem. 19th century telegraph cables suffered from signal degradation over long distances, just like modern fiber. Sarsfield's first Atlantic cable in 1858 failed after a few weeks, partly because the signal was so weak and the operators kept cranking up the voltage trying to compensate, eventually burning through the insulation. The solution in both eras was amplification along the route. In the telegraph era, they developed sensitive relays and eventually loading coils to boost the signal. In the modern fiber era, we have erbium-doped fiber amplifiers, repeaters spliced directly into the cable that boost the optical signal without converting it to electrical. The engineering problem was identical, and the solution pattern was identical. Marconi's wireless never had to solve the repeater problem across oceans. The ionosphere does some of that work for radio, and satellites handle the rest with entirely different physics.
I'll grant you the repeater lineage. But you're ignoring the fundamental architectural shift. Marconi proved that the medium could be the electromagnetic field itself. That's a philosophical break from the cable era that's more profound than any engineering continuity. The telegraph cable builders thought in terms of a continuous physical circuit from point A to point B. Marconi thought in terms of radiation, energy propagating through space. That's the paradigm we live in now. Even your precious subsea fiber cables are managed through wireless telemetry, monitored by satellite, integrated into a network architecture that treats the physical layer as just one option among many.
The philosophical break is real, I won't deny that. But Daniel's question is about who the true forerunners are. And forerunner status isn't about who had the more elegant concept. It's about whose infrastructure, whose operational patterns, whose institutional knowledge actually built the network we use today. And that is unambiguously the cable builders. Let me give you a concrete example. The modern submarine cable industry is dominated by a handful of companies: Subcom, Alcatel Submarine Networks, NEC, Huawei Marine. Their cable-laying ships are named things like CS Dependable and CS Responder. CS stands for Cable Ship, a designation that dates directly back to the 19th century telegraph cable fleet. The ships have dynamic positioning systems and ROVs now, but the basic job is the same. Spool thousands of kilometers of cable, sail a precise route, lay it on the seabed, bury it in shallow water to protect against anchors and trawling. That's not a metaphor, it's the same industry, evolved.
Here's where I think you're underselling Marconi. You're focusing entirely on point-to-point transoceanic links. Marconi's real descendant isn't the subsea cable, it's the entire broadcast and mobile communications ecosystem. When Marconi built the Wellfleet station, he wasn't just building a point-to-point link. He was demonstrating that a single transmitter could reach multiple receivers across a vast area. That's the architecture of broadcasting, of cellular base stations, of satellite downlinks. The subsea cable is a point-to-point pipe. The internet as a whole is point-to-multipoint at the edges, and that architecture comes from wireless thinking, not from telegraph thinking.
I'll give you broadcasting. That's a fair point. But Daniel's prompt is specifically about subsea fiber optic cables as the backbone of the internet. And on that narrow question, the cable builders win. Let me throw some numbers at you. As of 2026, there are roughly 500 active subsea cables spanning over 1.4 million kilometers. They carry something like $10 trillion in financial transactions daily. The latency on the Hibernia Express cable between New York and London is under 60 milliseconds. Every single one of those cables was laid by a ship that is the direct descendant of the Great Eastern. The route planning, the landing station architecture, the international consortium model for funding, all of it comes from the telegraph era.
The consortium model is an interesting point. The first transatlantic telegraph cable was funded by a mix of British and American investors, with government backing. Modern subsea cables are often funded by consortiums of telecom companies and hyperscalers. Google, Meta, Microsoft, Amazon are all investing heavily in their own cable systems now. The institutional pattern is similar.
And Cyrus Field, the American businessman who pushed through the 1858 and 1866 Atlantic cables, is a much closer ancestor to today's subsea cable project managers than Marconi ever was. Field spent years raising money, dealing with skeptical investors, managing catastrophic technical failures, and eventually succeeding through sheer persistence. The 1858 cable worked for about 3 weeks before it failed. Field had to go back, raise more money, wade through the Civil War, and try again in 1865 and 1866. That pattern, the multi-year infrastructure project with massive capital requirements and high technical risk, that's exactly what a modern subsea cable deployment looks like.
Marconi had his own version of that persistence. The Wellfleet station's towers kept collapsing in storms, and he kept rebuilding them. He was fighting against the same skepticism. Lots of physicists at the time said transatlantic radio was impossible because radio waves travel in straight lines and the curvature of the Earth should block them. Marconi didn't have a theoretical explanation for why it worked. The ionosphere wasn't understood yet. He just kept building bigger antennas and more powerful spark gap transmitters until it did work. That's an engineering mindset, not just a conceptual leap.
And I'll give Marconi credit for something else. He understood the strategic importance of what he was building. The Wellfleet station was positioned to serve transatlantic shipping routes. Ships equipped with Marconi wireless sets could communicate with shore stations hundreds of miles out at sea. This transformed maritime safety. The Titanic disaster in 1912 was a Marconi wireless story as much as it was a shipbuilding story. The survivors were rescued because the Carpathia received the Titanic's wireless distress call. That's a direct line from Marconi's vision to the modern world where we take ubiquitous connectivity for granted.
That's exactly my point. Marconi's vision was about connectivity everywhere, not just along a cable route. A subsea cable connects two landing stations. Marconi's wireless connected ships at sea, lighthouses, remote stations, places where running a cable was physically impossible. That vision of ubiquitous coverage is what drives modern satellite constellations like Starlink. Thousands of low Earth orbit satellites providing internet access to places where no cable will ever reach. That's Marconi's true legacy.
Except Starlink satellites are connected to the internet through ground stations that are connected to fiber backbones. The satellites are an access layer, not the backbone. The backbone is still cables. Even the inter-satellite laser links that Starlink is deploying, those are optical, point-to-point links in space, which is conceptually closer to a subsea cable than to Marconi's spark gap broadcasts.
Okay, but you're defining the question in a way that guarantees your side wins. If the question is what carries the most bits across oceans, it's cables, obviously. But if the question is whose vision of connectivity shaped the modern world, Marconi has a stronger claim. The idea that you can send information through the air without wires was genuinely revolutionary. It broke the mental model that communication required a physical circuit. Every time you pull out your phone and it connects to a cell tower, you're living in Marconi's world, not Cyrus Field's.
I think we're converging on something useful here. The subsea cable builders gave us the physical infrastructure pattern. The ships, the repeaters, the landing stations, the consortium financing model. Marconi gave us the conceptual architecture of wireless connectivity, the idea that the medium could be the electromagnetic spectrum itself. The modern internet is a hybrid of both. The backbone is cables, the access layer is wireless, and the two are deeply integrated.
There's one more thing Marconi gave us that's worth mentioning, the regulatory framework for spectrum management. Before wireless, nobody had to worry about who was transmitting on what frequency. Marconi's commercial success created the need for international coordination. The first International Radio Telegraph Convention was held in 1906 in Berlin, largely because Marconi stations were interfering with each other and with other operators. That convention established the principle that nations would coordinate spectrum use, a principle that eventually led to the International Telecommunication Union's modern role in managing satellite orbits and frequency allocations. The entire global framework for managing the electromagnetic spectrum traces back to Marconi's commercial pressure.
That's a strong point. And the cable builders had their own regulatory legacy. The International Convention for the Protection of Submarine Telegraph Cables was signed in 1884, establishing rules for cable laying and penalties for damaging cables. Modern subsea cable protection law descends directly from that convention, so both traditions generated international regulatory frameworks that are still in force.
I want to go back to Wellfleet itself for a moment, because there's a detail about the station that I think captures something important about early wireless. The South Wellfleet station used a spark gap transmitter, which produced what's called damped waves, essentially a burst of radio energy that decayed rapidly, like ringing a bell. These were incredibly inefficient by modern standards. They splattered across a wide bandwidth, interfered with everything, and were hard to tune precisely. By the 1910s, the industry was moving toward continuous wave transmitters using arc converters and eventually vacuum tubes, which produced a pure, tunable carrier wave. The Wellfleet station was obsolete within a decade of being built.
Which is another parallel with subsea cables. The 1858 cable was obsolete almost immediately. It used a design that was barely adequate, the insulation was inconsistent, and the signaling protocol was basically send very high voltage and hope. The 1866 cable was a complete redesign with better materials and more conservative engineering. Both traditions, wireless and wired, went through the same cycle of ambitious early failure, followed by more mature second-generation success.
The Wellfleet station's physical fate is almost a metaphor for technological obsolescence. The cliff eroded. The towers fell. The building went into the Atlantic. The National Park Service now maintains the site as a historical landmark, but there's almost nothing left except concrete pads and some interpretive signs. Meanwhile, the subsea cable landing stations that dot the New England coast, places like Lynn, Massachusetts, and Narragansett, Rhode Island, those are still operational, still carrying traffic, still being upgraded. The wired infrastructure proved more durable than the wireless.
Though to be fair, the modern cable landing stations are not the same buildings as the 19th century ones. They've been rebuilt and upgraded continuously. The Marconi site at Wellfleet was abandoned and left to the elements. If someone had kept investing in it, maybe there'd be a functioning radio observatory or a satellite ground station there today.
Actually, there's an interesting counterfactual. The Cape Cod National Seashore was established in 1961 by President Kennedy. If the Marconi site hadn't been preserved as part of that park, it probably would have fallen into the ocean completely by now with no trace left. The preservation impulse came from recognizing the historical significance. And that recognition was about Marconi as a pioneer, not about the subsea cable builders. The public remembers Marconi. Nobody outside of telecom history nerds remembers Cyrus Field.
That's a fair point about public memory, but public memory is a terrible metric for actual technological lineage. Most people think Edison invented the light bulb, but the real story is much more complicated. The subsea cable builders are the unsung infrastructure heroes who actually built the network that the modern world runs on. Marconi gets the fame. Field and his successors get the results.
Let me push back on one thing you said earlier, that 99% of intercontinental traffic goes through subsea cables. That's true for data volume, but it's not true for connectivity. The number of devices connected wirelessly across continents, through satellite phones, maritime radios, aircraft communications, remote IoT sensors, is growing exponentially. And in a crisis, when cables are cut, which happens surprisingly often, about 100 times a year from anchors and fishing trawlers, wireless backup links kick in. The future of global connectivity is probably a mesh where cables carry the bulk traffic and wireless fills the gaps and provides resilience.
I don't disagree with that future. But the question is about ancestry, not about the future. And ancestry is about lineage. The subsea fiber cable is a direct descendant of the subsea telegraph cable. The fiber is glass instead of copper. The signals are photons instead of electrons. But the operational DNA, the ships, the routes, the landing stations, the repeater spacing, the international consortium model, is continuous. Marconi's spark gap transmitter has no direct descendant in the modern network stack. It was an evolutionary dead end. Continuous wave transmitters, vacuum tubes, transistors, integrated circuits, those all came from different lineages. Marconi's specific technology didn't survive, even if his vision did.
That's a strong argument. The operational DNA versus the conceptual DNA. I think we're actually in agreement on the facts and just weighting them differently. The operational continuity is with the cable builders. The conceptual continuity is with Marconi. And the modern internet needs both.
We've argued ourselves into a synthesis. How very disappointing for the listeners who wanted a fight.
They got a fight. It was just a constructive fight.
Here's what I'll say in closing on the Wellfleet piece. If you visit the Marconi site today, and I have, years ago, you stand on that cliff and look at the Atlantic, and you can see the concrete foundations of the towers. They're not dramatic. They're just rectangles of weathered concrete in the scrub grass. But you're standing on ground that's going to fall into the ocean eventually. The erosion hasn't stopped. In 50 years, those foundations might be gone too. And there's something about that impermanence that captures the whole history. The most advanced technology of 1903 is now a historical footnote on an eroding cliff, while the boring copper cables laid on the ocean floor evolved into the backbone of global civilization.
Yet, when you pull out your phone on that same cliff and get a signal from a cell tower somewhere inland, you're experiencing Marconi's legacy. The phone doesn't care about the subsea cable that might be carrying the data once it leaves the tower. It just knows that it can connect, wirelessly, to the global network. That moment of connection, the magic of information appearing out of thin air, that's what Marconi gave us. The cable builders gave us reliability, capacity, and permanence. Marconi gave us the sense of possibility.
That's a good place to land. The cable builders built the backbone. Marconi imagined the freedom. Both were necessary. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1944, a U-Navy patrol plane made an emergency landing on a remote atoll in Kiribati and discovered that the lagoon's waters were stained a vivid crimson, nearly mistaking it for a chemical weapon test site. It turned out to be a massive seasonal bloom of bacteria that produced a red pigment almost chemically identical to the dye used in Japanese military uniforms. And for about 6 weeks, Allied intelligence seriously investigated whether the Japanese were farming uniform dye in the Central Pacific.
The things that almost became intelligence briefings.
Almost chemically identical to Japanese uniform dye.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and thanks to DeepSeek V4 Pro for the script today. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It actually helps. We're at myweirdprompts.com for the full archive. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.